welcome into Woods and Water, South Carolina. Hope you're having a great start to the Memorial Day weekend. Remember, if you're out there on the water, be careful. This is the beginning of the 100 deadly days of summer, so be careful if you're out there boating. Watch for the other driver. Have a second captain. You know, that's one of the things they recommend when you're out there on the water. Have a second captain. So anyway, I'm caught between a rock and a hard place today of being out of town and having a pig picking at about the time this show is starting. So I'm going to reach back. We're going to listen to Dr. Kurt Verkotteren. He was on with us. He's the feral swine project leader for USDA. And it was a great interview. So hope you enjoy the replay of the show. Welcome back to Woods and Water, South Carolina. I am prone to just pick up the phone and call somebody or email somebody just out of nowhere because there's an issue that I'd like to have more information on. And if you haven't read it yet, there are going to be some tests on pigs in Texas and Alabama starting this spring. And when I read the story, there was a gentleman in there who was quoted quite often. I did a little research, found out where he was, tracked him down. He made the mistake of answering my email, and we have him on the phone. Dr. Kurt Verkotteren, feral swine deer elk project leader from the National Wildlife Research Center in Fort Collins, Colorado. Thank you for taking time out of your day to be on Woods and Water, South Carolina.
Sure. Happy to be here.
Yes, sir. I'm sure when your email opened up and you said some guy from South Carolina, you were like, oh boy, here we go.
You're exactly right.
But you answered it, and I appreciate it, and that's how the information gets out there, because this is information pertinent to South Carolina. We have pigs all over the low country. They're starting to migrate up the rivers into the middle parts of the state. We've even got some here in the mountains in the upstate of South Carolina. So it's something that every deer hunter knows about. A lot of people say, I want pigs. And when they get them, they say, I wish I never had them.
Right.
You know, so I was at the check station processor just the other day, and a guy came in with a pig, and he hunts about 20 miles from where I hunt. And we don't have pigs where I am, and he's got plenty of them, you know, and he's like, it's just separated by a few miles. So it's just a matter of time before I guess we're all got them.
Well, unless we do something about it, right?
That's right. And that's why you're here. I introduced you. I told you, tell everybody who you are and where you're from. Give us just a little bit of background on yourself, if you don't mind.
Sure. Well, I'm a wildlife researcher. I work for the USDA. And within the USDA, there's a branch called Wildlife Services. Wildlife Services, that a lot of you folks are probably familiar with, we focus on human-wildlife conflict, mostly protecting agriculture.
Okay.
It might be protecting crops from being damaged by wildlife or livestock from being predated by wildlife. That's our operational branch, and they're very active in your state. We do a lot of pig control work in your state, actually, and Okay. Other species, too, a lot of coyote work.
All right.
And then with the Wildlife Services, there's a small branch of researchers, and that's what I'm part of, the National Wildlife Research Center. So my job is to develop the tools that our operations guys can use to help landowners and stakeholders. So our center is based out of Fort Collins, Colorado, but we've got 9 other field stations around the country that are devoted to different kinds of damage and wildlife issues related to where they're at. For example, we've got a field station in Logan, Utah, and they are just focused on predator damage, mostly coyotes, wolves, those sorts of things.
Okay.
We've got one in Mississippi that's mostly aquaculture, protecting catfish farms and things from birds that depredate on catfish.
The old great blue heron.
You're right on, exactly. So we got a couple of these field stations around the country, and then we've got the headquarters here in Fort Collins that I'm based out of. So, but we're nationwide. Even though I'm out of Fort Collins, it doesn't mean I spend much time here.
I bet. I actually have a good friend who's an outdoor writer, Pete Rogers, who works for USDA, and he traps beavers. Anytime the South Carolina Department of Transportation has a problem with a beaver building a dam that's endangering a road or roadbed or something like that, they call him out. He goes and traps the beavers, and he absolutely loves it.
Right. Well, if you ever had some of our wildlife services guys from South Carolina on your program before, you might want to consider that, because it's really an active, progressive, great program.
Yeah, I am. Actually, Pete and I are hitting the road, or will be in Indianapolis at the Archery Trade Association together, and I was going to pin his ears back and get him to come on and co-host the show with me, talk a little bit about the Archery Trade Association, but then talk a little bit about, you know, the USDA, their beaver control operation, and the other things they do right here in South Carolina. So, yes, that is one thing that is very high on my radar right now.
Cool.
Would you like first to refer to them as swine, pigs? How do you, it's feral swine to you guys, which is, feral is what, just a domesticated animal that's run wild, so to speak?
Yes. Traditionally, feral means domestic, has reverted back a few generations and has gone back to wild. I think the most accurate thing to call it is probably wild pigs.
Okay.
Because depending on where you are in the country, they may not all just be domestics that have reverted back to the wild, but they could have been Eurasian or Russian boars that were introduced for hunting purposes, sometimes behind a high fence that got out. So then they aren't really feral. Technically quite as feral. They're just right. Relocated wild. So wild pigs is a good catch-all.
When someone sees a pig in the wild, okay, is there a way to tell whether it's just a feral pig that's a few generations removed from being in the hog pen, or one of those, what we call the Russian boar type?
There are differences, and this just kind of came to light to me within the last few years. Most of my pig research work has always been done in the South, and a lot of it in Texas.
Okay.
And a lot of them are just kind of nondescript black,
right,
some different color phases and things. So it seems like the more generations that they are in the wild, they kind of revert back to this thin haired, different shades of blacks and grays.
Okay.
But there's always some of those spots left. And those, for the most part, are your feral swine. Who knows how many generations they've been out.
Sure.
But there's not much of that Eurasian left in them. And then I went up to Michigan to trap a bunch of pigs to put some collars on and start working on that population. And they're a different pig. They remind me of the ones I worked on in Spain.
Oh, wow.
A lot thicker hair, shorter hair, but really thick, more grizzled. And then other characteristics are different, too. The shape of their skulls are different, longer. I mean, one-third of their body is their head, super long snouts on them, more pronounced tusks. So there are differences, and we've actually got a pretty cool genetics project going on here.
Okay.
Where we're collecting samples, since we're controlling pigs all over the country, we're collecting samples from them to put together the genetic history. You know, like ancestry.com
sure,
for pigs?
Sure.
So we are able to determine what's where and what the heritage is, where they came from. And one of the neatest things that these data are showing is some of the big jumps that these pigs make, to the point that it's pretty obvious, hey, this pig didn't walk from here to here. He must have been in the back of a pickup.
Wow.
Yeah, there's examples. There's crazy examples. There's one from California where agencies were on a mission to eradicate the pigs from an island that they'd been introduced to.
Okay.
Because, you know, these invasive pigs were really impacting the few species of native animals on these islands. I can't even think of what it all was, but there's some native mammals.
Okay.
As well as native birds that are pretty vulnerable. And the pigs were really impacting these ground nesting birds because they didn't evolve with something like a pig that would come and eat the nest and catch the young and things. Because those pigs have been on those islands for so long, their genetics were quite different from mainland pigs. So the effort goes into removing these pigs, and lo and behold, some of their genetics showed up in Northern California.
Wow.
Meaning some of them left the island live and were trucked somewhere else for somebody's, you know, bad idea for hunting fun.
Tell us, you know, like I said, they're prevalent across the Southeast, have been for a while now. Are they in all 50 states or are close to being in all 50 states now?
Yes. When our program started, in our National Feral Swine Damage Management Program started about 4 years ago, it was a congressional initiative to help the states by putting some federal effort into figuring out this pig situation and starting to help get the pigs under control. So about 4 years ago, we determined that there were pigs in about 40 states, and we've been able to eradicate them from a few. So we're down to about 34 states now, but that sounds like great progress, and it is. but the states that we've eradicated the pigs from, those are kind of low-hanging fruits.
Sure.
It's going to be, you know, we'll never get them out of some states like probably yours, right?
Right. I'm sure you won't. You know, eradication, it's a big topic. I guess where all this is going is trapping and hunting like we do is not controlling them enough to stay up on the population, is it?
No. You know, we've got some really good data to show that hunting doesn't serve for feral swine.
Okay.
It's not serving to even slow down the growth of these populations. And since the state wildlife agencies and federal agencies like us and SQUIS out of the University of Georgia have been really paying attention, which is like the 80s, the populations are just been going up and up and up until we started to put this more governmental effort into it. Now, there are things we can do to try to really help use hunters to help the situation, but there's a lot of education that needs to be done too so that people start to wrap their heads around the impacts of these pigs. For example, and I like to kill a pig when I can too to bring home, but no longer do I view them as just a bonus on my deer hunt, because I'm realizing and our research is really showing the impacts that they can have on the native species that we really like to hunt, the wild turkeys and the bobwhite quail.
Sure.
And then I've got a lot of partners who are looking at other species that they might impact that aren't game species, but other ground nesting birds or you know, in a coastal state like yours, if you've got sea turtles, the pigs learn to go searching for those nests and just wipe out those nests. So they're really having wide scale impacts beyond just damaging crops, even.
Which is a big one. Crop damage is probably, well, economically is huge. How big a problem is crop damage in the U.S. every year?
Yeah, we are really trying to wrap our heads around that one, and it's a kind of a tough question to answer. We know that it's probably about $2.5 billion per year of crops that are damaged by feral swine, and that's probably very, very conservative, but that's the number that we're at right now. We've got some NAS, you know, the USDA surveys that go out to producers.
Okay.
Surveys going on to help us get a handle on nationwide the amounts of damage. We're starting to look at varying crops, and we're putting a lot of effort into that to try to get at that number. Some of that research is actually being done in your state there. We've got some effort going on at the Congaree National Wildlife Refuge, where we're looking at damage adjacent to it and how control efforts, you know, how much effort is being put into control and what's that costing,
right?
And how much are we saving the local producers adjacent to it? That's kind of what the angles we're getting at to help us get an idea of kind of the return on investment. If we put these dollars into reducing pig populations in this area, how much do we save American producers in that area?
I got you. Let me ask you this question. If, you know, I was down I won't say it because my hunting buddy will jump all over me for giving away where we're going, but we were down at a public land out along the Lowcountry, and a beautiful piece of land, just, you know, big cypress trees and standing water, and, you know, we're walking roads, and off the sides of the road, it just, you know, looked like somebody went through with a turn plow.
Yeah.
Is pig sign here in South Carolina the same as pig sign in California, as pig sign is in Illinois? I mean, is it just a rooting all around? Is that what every one of them does?
It really is, and depending on the habitats, you know, they may not look the exact same, but yeah, that rooting is very much a telltale sign. And I've seen it in all those places you've mentioned.
Okay.
Swamps in Michigan, where there hadn't been pigs in recent years, that's how we know where it could be. There's very small populations. I think we've actually got them all out of the lower peninsula of Michigan now.
Okay.
That's how we find them, because they'll go to these swampy areas,
right?
And that rooting is our clue. You can have trail cameras out and whatever else, but they aren't coming to bait. They aren't. The populations are so low that you just don't see them. They're like they're like yetis, you know.
Sure.
But you can't hide the rooting.
No, you can't hide the sign. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to mention the last time I was in South Carolina, something that was real obvious to me and the researchers I was working with, who are a couple of just fantastic pig researchers out of the Savannah River Ecology Station there.
Sure.
In some of the rooting that we were looking at, it was interesting that there was invasive plants coming in the rooting. So now you have this invasive animal, the pig,
and
causing
plant.
This damage, but he's creating an environment where the native plants are getting outcompeted by invasive weeds in the areas that were rooted. So it's like a double whammy.
My goodness, I had no clue, because normally when you disturb natural ground with a discar or a fire or whatever, you get the native plants to come back. But the pigs are actually, I guess, taking care of the native plants while they can get going, and now you got them. Wow. That's even worse. I just thought it was affecting, agriculture, and like I said, like you said, they'll nesting birds and they'll run deer off,
that's another thing that, our research center and with partners at universities and things, we'll have to look into quantifying. But so native ecosystems are going to slowly be changed by the activities of pigs, by the rooting behavior.
Wow. They carry a lot of bacteria, disease, and stuff like that. Hit on a couple, because this is not simply just about hunting. It's agriculture, it's the environment. But there's also threats to other animals and people, too, with some of the diseases that they carry.
Yeah, that's a really good point, especially since you're talking from South Carolina, which is one of the leading pork-producing states in the country. And, as a lot of you guys realize, most pork-producing operations are really quite biosecure.
Sure.
And that's because domestic pigs get sick pretty easy, so you have to have really high standards. Those facilities are shower in and shower out for the employees so that they don't bring the bugs from their kids' daycare into their pork producing facility, things like that, to protect the pigs. But yeah, you're right. In the wild, they do carry quite a few different pathogens. We know that in the U.S., but everywhere we look, there'll be a percentage of the populations that will carry pseudorabies, which is a disease it's not the best name for it. It should be called pig venereal disease, really. It's sexually transmitted. But that's pseudorabies. Swine brucella also occurs in populations at pretty high percentages in some areas. And that's one that can cause abortions. It can, if it got into, say, domestic livestock, could have implications. We've got different kinds of brucella in wildlife, like up in the Yellowstone area, where it's in the elk and the bison, and then they give it to the cattle, and it has big impacts. So those same kinds of wildlife to domestic species transmissions have the potential to occur. So where it's most likely to occur with feral swine is going to be with kind of small, more the mom and pop, 4-H backyard pig operations. And I've got data from a study I did with a master's student a few years ago now in Texas, where once you put a GPS collar on a pig, on a wild pig, we know where it's going.
Okay.
And so I had data of this boar who was getting into pens and fraternizing with the domestics behind the fence.
No.
And I went and stopped with the family I wanted to check out their setup, And they had no clue. They told me that they had no wild pigs in the area. And I've got data of my pig in the pen with theirs. I never followed up, but I should have, because I bet you that they had some piglets that didn't look like the boar they had in the pen.
Where'd that black thing come from?
And there's other, you ask about diseases. There are other things that are more scary that other countries and continents are dealing with now that if we're not careful, we too will have to deal with. I'm thinking things like classical swine fever, African swine fever, foot and mouth disease. If diseases like that were introduced into the U.S., it would have huge, huge trade implications. I actually take off in a couple of days to go to Italy, where there's a consortium of 30 European countries. And in Italy or in Europe, a lot of their countries are about the size of our states.
Right. Right.
Where they want to put a plan into place to make sure they're communicating between their countries on how to prevent them physically trucking diseases back and forth across across their boundaries. And then, you know, the elephant in the room then is, well, what about the wildlife that doesn't respect boundaries and goes back and forth across these boundaries?
Sure.
So that's why I'm being brought in. So these disease issues, even where the pigs are native, because in Europe, they're native.
Right.
When I go there and I call them feral hogs or something that sounds kind of demeaning, they always correct me. No, 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 Dr. Verkaudrin. These are not feral swine. These are the wild boar. They belong. And they do, and they belong in that environment. But the same issues exist in that pigs get about every disease. They give it to the others, and they travel pretty large distances.
Wow. You know, you said foot and mouth disease. It takes me back to a kid. I used to read books by Dr. James Herriot, who was a veterinarian in, you know, some hamlet or town over there in England or whatever. And boy, I tell you, foot and mouth, it was like that was the disease that could bring everything to a stop.
Well, isn't it the truth? And so that's, you know, so our agency, Wildlife Services and National Wildlife Research Center, those sorts of things are on our mind. And if, for example, foot and mouth shows up on the coast of South Carolina in a sheep are going out operation, we can go in there and we can take care of that pretty easily.
Okay.
But then if the landowner says, yeah, but what about the white-tailed deer and the wild pigs that have been kind of coming and going?
Right.
Now we're in trouble, right?
So right.
We do try to be proactive, and colleagues and I have done research to on this topic to test quick to erect fences.
Okay.
So that if we can kind of go in and take care of all the domestics in an area where there's a small foot and mouth disease introduction, but we've done work to say, okay, now we know, depending on how much time has lapsed since the disease may have been introduced, how far the disease may have traveled in the wild to know how big of an area we need to say fence off. And then that way you're containing any animal that may be infected, and you're preventing any animals from the outside that likely aren't infected from getting in.
Okay.
And then you can go in and control the animals within that big fence. So you know, we've got some things in place, and it kind of scares me that I wouldn't doubt that in my career I'll have to use some of these ideas. Feel the power of love.
Coming from a hunter standpoint, you know, my first thing, like CWEHD, is what's the effect on the whitetail population? But that's just a tiny part of what their effect could be.
Yeah, no doubt. And I'm a deer guy, so it's near and dear to me, too, to be thinking about these issues relative to deer. But as we talk about these 40 states where we've got pigs, there's a lot of overlap with deer. So they're sharing the same space.
Yeah. You know, a lot of people that have pigs say they see very few deer. The deer just don't like being around the pigs.
Well, then let's control the pigs and get our deer back.
Yeah, that's right. That's what we need to do. You know, that's a lot of background information, and I appreciate it more than you know. But I want to go to what y'all are going to start doing this spring in Alabama and Texas on a limited basis, and that's testing it's a toxic bait. Tell us what you're going to be testing in those two states to try to control populations through means other than trapping and hunting.
Right. Okay. Well, you know, it's become pretty clear that we just need more tools to help remove pigs from the landscape. So with partners, this is a big effort. You've got us, the USDA. We've got Australian partners, their governments and some private industry. We've got New Zealand partners, and a version of this toxicant is already being used operationally in New Zealand.
Okay.
Our partners in Australia have it really far along the way. It's not fully registered yet, but it's really close.
Okay.
And in the U.S., we're right behind them getting our ducks in a row. A lot of our preliminary research has been done in Texas in cooperation with the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department and Texas Department of Agriculture. We have systematically been chipping away at building a foundation of studies to evaluate this product, sodium nitrite.
Okay.
Sodium nitrite is a really heavy salt. And one of the reasons that we chose it is because there's a lot known about it already, and that's because it's a food additive. It's actually a preservative, kind of ironically. it was probably in the bacon or sausage you had for breakfast this morning.
Okay.
So it's used to preserve pork, and in heavier doses, it can be used to eliminate pork on the hoof. So the commercial name of the product is going to be Hog-On, but the active ingredient is sodium nitrite. We've, like I mentioned, we've done several studies on it from every angle possible.
Okay.
There's old literature that kind of got us on this from the 60s showing that pigs are more susceptible to it. They die from it at lower doses than other species. So they're just especially susceptible to it.
Why is that?
Now, when we first started trying it as a toxicant, we couldn't get the pigs to eat it because they're smart. And they've got really keen senses of smell and senses of taste and the stuff is salty. So it took several iterations for us to get a formulation that the pigs will accept. So we actually have to microencapsulate the salt. So you essentially think of a candy around a Tootsie Roll Pop or the peanut in an M&M. You know, you're hiding the
sugar,
hiding the salt in the candy coating.
Okay.
So that they'll consume it. And then we hide that then in an attractive bait, and we've done pen studies, and with our colleagues in Australia, we've done field studies to show that it can be very, very effective.
Okay.
At the same time, because we've got a bigger challenge in the U.S. than Australian or New Zealand partners, those lucky guys, they don't have as many non-targets to worry about as we do. In large enough quantity, sodium nitrite will also kill other species too. So hand in glove with developing the toxicant, we've been working on developing delivery boxes that are pig specific.
Okay.
So we've got a nice delivery box that's working well everywhere except for, I'd say, where there's black bears. Right now, we wouldn't want to use it where there might be risk to black bears.
Okay.
But we can keep raccoons and deer and rodents out quite effectively with our current box. So it's not going to be a silver bullet.
Okay.
It's just going to be another tool in the toolbox, just like trapping. There's a lot of pre-baiting required. Oftentimes, we'll start our pre-baiting with corn, and we'll shift them to a placebo bait, the same kind of bait matrix, just without the toxic in it.
Okay.
And then we've got to train them to our box and what those boxes look like. It's essentially a trough with a lid that kind of overlaps the edges and then it's shut and held shut with 30 pounds of magnet pressure. We've done studies to show that pretty young pigs can open these boxes with their rooting behavior. You know, they're used to using their noses to root through the dirt and to get at food. So when they smell the attractive bait, they pop that lid right open. And even if there's a pig or two who's not smart enough to pop the lid open, it's okay because they travel like a school of fish.
So right.
As long as one pops the lid open, it stays open because all so many heads are in the bin until the last one leaves. So it works for us. But that baiting period from getting them onto a bait site until they're accustomed to using the bait box, yeah, that can take a couple, 3 weeks, just like pre-bait for trapping. So it's not like it's going to be...
drop it one day,
you know,
they eat
heads
it the
and
next
tails
day.
More effective than trapping, maybe.
Right, yeah. You're not going to put it out there one day, they eat it, and they're gone the third day. It's a process.
Right. And depending on the area, for example, right now we're doing some work in Texas where when you show up, you don't know how hard it's going to be to get the pigs on bait. If they've been on bait and every time they come into bait, they're being shot over, it may be hard.
Sure.
And so there's some strategies to that, of course. That's why we're doing the trial in Texas in late winter when the natural foods, the agricultural foods are the least abundant. So the pigs are hungry. We should be able to get them to come in. And then when we do our field trial in Alabama, we'll do that one in summer when the pigs are kind of concentrated more in, where there's areas with water.
Okay.
Our operations personnel, at the end of the day, if this product becomes registered, and I should talk about that a little bit, but if and when it becomes registered, it'll be wildlife services personnel or state wildlife department personnel working in cooperation with us who will be the ones using it.
Okay.
It's not going to be available at the feed store or anything. It's going to be only used by us, at least for the first several years. If it goes well and there's no problems, maybe the restrictions would be loosened up and there'd be some sort of a training, like certified pest control operators could use it. But that'd be way down the road. But why I mention that is because in every state, just like trapping, the guys in the field will know how best to use the tool to optimize its success.
Okay, gotcha. What is the effect, you know, we talk about, what's the effect of sodium nitrate on a pig?
Right, I mean, that's a good question. A big part of why we went with this toxicant is because it's about as humane as a toxicant can be. You know, nobody loves the idea of using a poison to kill animals with, but in this situation, it's the responsible thing to do. So as a agency, we want to do it as responsibly as we can.
Certainly.
And others before us in Australia, and then we've done studies ourselves to see how sodium nitrate kills. And so upon ingestion of this salt, the sodium nitrite, when exposed to air and moisture, so as soon as it gets in the stomach, this shell I talked about, the microencapsulation, is broken down, and they get a flush of salt to their system, and a process called methemoglobinemia occurs. And what this is, it's really very similar to carbon monoxide poison. And so the animals will kind of get faint, and we've done studies to document all this, see how it works. They'll ingest it. Within about an hour, they just start feeling good. They'll just kind of go and lay down. They'll kind of fuzz off and go to sleep.
Okay.
And then it's like they slip into a coma and just don't wake up. So by 2.5 hours, they're dead. And just like CO2 again, if they didn't get enough of the dose, they might get sick and they might go and fuzz off, and then they might wake up and just walk away happy as can be or come back for another mouthful of bait. So it's kind of no harm, no foul if they don't get a large enough dose. It's not like they are representing any kind of a threat to any other animals to be poisoned or anything like that, which is another really good point. When you're using a poison, you have to be concerned about secondary hazards.
Sure.
What happens to, say, the scavenger that consumes an animal killed by the poison.
Right.
And that's the beauty of sodium nitrite. By the time that a scavenger is working on a carcass, the sodium nitrite is gassed off and dissipated. So we've done studies to show this. I've also run a lot of the rabies research here at the center over the years. So I'm lucky enough to have some coyotes and some raccoons and things on hand.
Okay.
So we fed small pigs heavy, heavy doses of sodium nitrite. As soon as they tipped over, we threw them in with coyotes, and none of the coyotes were ever affected, partly because they just don't eat those right body parts. So even to help make it happen, I would unzip the coyotes from, tip to tail over the guts to try to help the coyotes maybe eat the worst parts.
Okay.
Because the sodium nitrite, for example, it never makes it to muscle tissue.
Sure, right.
It's just going to be maybe in the stomach lining, but mostly in the gut contents. And since nothing will eat the gut contents, we haven't had any secondary hazards. Besides trying this with the coyotes, like I mentioned, our partners there at Texas Department of Wildlife and Parks, they did the same study with vultures, where we would intoxicate a pig and then throw them in cages with several vultures. Then the vultures would pick them clean, and there's never any impacts on the vultures.
Which means there's going to be no impact to humans.
Right.
We eat it every day.
And even beyond that, because the death occurs so quickly, the chances that a person unknowingly harvest an intoxicated pig, it'd be just in that little short period, right?
Right.
So the only potential hazard would be if somebody were to say use the stomach wall to in some kind of, I don't know what kind of recipes you got in South Carolina there, Roger.
Maybe just see the sausage roll or something. Yeah.
The stomach wall. You know, there could be some present, but because it's going to be exposed to that air, that moisture, and then cooked, you know, it's really, really unlikely that there'll be any sodium nitrite present.
Wow.
And even related to that, another question someone might ask is, okay. Well, what if you intoxicate a pig and eat your poison, and then they catch it in a trap and they want to haul it off for processing or whatever? Well, if it truly got a dose in its stomach, it's going to die before you get to where you're going. Or if it overcomes the dose, it's just another pig. It's
right.
The sodium nitrite will have gassed off, metabolized away, essentially.
All of this because research shows that you've got to remove 70% of the population each year just to stay constant.
Yeah, this is, you know,
unreal.
When I first started working with pigs, because all my previous, not all of it, but a lot of my previous research had been focused on deer and elk.
Okay.
You know, I kind of think like a deer and elk researcher.
Okay.
I've had to sort of adjust and think more like a rodent researcher, because pigs are more like big rodents because they'll have these multiple litters per year.
Okay.
And they have large litters. One of my best friends, one of his best sayings is when he's asked how many piglets do they have per litter? They'll say, oh, they'll have 6 to 7 per litter and 12 or 13 will survive. which is just the truth. You know, they're so prolific, especially right. In environments like yours there where the weather's right. So 2 litters, probably averaging 6 to 9, pretty normal. And some of the research that's being done in your neighborhood by Dr. James Beasley from the University of Georgia,
okay.
He's working at the Savannah River Ecology Site.
Right.
They're doing some really interesting research to show how it doesn't take too long. And I think you've had John Kilgo on your show before.
Yes, I have. We've done several
John's
coyote
shows. Research. Those guys are doing some really cool stuff to show that when a piglet hits the ground, it's not long before it's running and nothing can catch it. So the this is really quite high.
Wow. It's a lot of information to process, people. I hope you hope you made some notes. If somebody, and I appreciate the time you've given us, and I tell you what I'd like to do. I'd like to circle back around in 6, 8, 10 months and let's talk about this again a little bit. And do you think by that time you'd have some more test results from Texas and Alabama?
Yes, really. Let me just give you the timeline of how this could play out to be actually used operationally.
Okay.
So these two field studies that you're speaking of in Texas and Alabama, those are being done under an experimental use permit that the EPA has granted us based on the results of all this research that we've done to this point. So these will be the first two times where we're actually using it out in the wild, and we will monitor it like crazy. We're putting collars on all the pigs. We'll have trail cameras on the bait sites to know like how many pigs are coming in. We'll really, really monitor it very,
okay.
very well. And then we'll write up the results of those trials, summarize that, put it all together, and then it goes back to the EPA. And then they look over all those data, make sure that we haven't had any, you know, unexpected negative things happen, consider everything that we have. And then it's up to them to essentially bless it or not.
Okay.
And if they approve it, then that goes to the states, and it's up to the states to make their decision. And if the states want to make things more restrictive than the EPA did, then that's their call.
Okay.
So I would say the soonest that it could be being used operationally, if all the research goes really well, would probably be about 2020. It'll take a while.
And that's a good thing. You just want to make sure all the bases are covered and there's no unintended consequences.
No, you're exactly right. So we, the wildlife research community, we kind of by just the nature of the business, we're very, very conservative and if anything, overly responsible. I've spent most of my career doing non-lethal research, inventing techniques and ways to reduce human-wildlife conflict without actually killing the wildlife.
Sure.
So this is a little different for us. So we've really kind of ramped up to make sure that we are covering all of our bases as responsibly as possible.
If I'm not mistaken, in doing some research on your website and all, there's some tables by state on every animal that's come in contact that you've had to go out and our USDA personnel have had to go out and have contact with. And there's columns for, you know, removed or euthanized or whatever. So it's not all just about eradicating. Sometimes it's me moving an animal out of an area.
Right, depending on the species and what we're up to. But yeah, of course, you're wildlife biologists, wildlife researchers. We love wildlife probably more than the next guy, right?
It is your life, and you obviously enjoy it.
You bet.
You bet. Dr. Verkaderin, I appreciate you taking so much time out of your day to be on Woods and Water South Carolina. I would love to get back in touch with you later on. Keep me posted, if you will. If somebody wants more information on the USDA APHIS Feral Swine Project, where do they go to get that?
Well, we do have websites, so just do a web search or go directly to our website, www.aphis.usda.gov/wildlife-damage/feral-swine. We'll get you to our feral swine website. That's our whole feral swine damage management program. And then my branch, the research branch, if you just search wildlife damage, National Wildlife Research Center, you'll get to our center.
That is great. I appreciate you doing this for me. If you are ever in South Carolina, you must let me know. I would love to meet you.
I go there pretty often. We'll cross paths sometime.
Absolutely. I've actually, one of my good friends went from the National Wild Turkey Federation to the Savannah River Ecology Lab. And I'm supposed to be going down there sometime this spring to get kind of a rundown of what they're doing, research they're doing down there. Ostensibly it came from coyotes, but he says there's so much more research going on down there that he wants me to come down for a day and just look at every program and figure out what we can talk about here on the radio show to educate people, say, look, this is happening right here in our backyard. So it's I would love to cross paths with you.
Yeah, the Savannah Lab folks, they are world class. Do make a point of meeting them.
They do. He was telling me that some of their scientists are the scientists that still go and monitor Chernobyl from right here, which is...
Yeah, that's Dr. James Beasley.
That's right.
He's a partner with me on a lot of this feral swine work.
Wow. Small world when it comes to the research. You guys, you do a yeoman's job, and we really appreciate it. Thank you for being on Woods and Water South Carolina, and I look forward to talking to you again soon.
All right. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye. There you go, folks. A lot of information. Something if you're a hunter, you deal with already. If you're not a hunter, you're a farmer, you deal with it. The rest of us are going to at some point. So hang on through the break. We'll be back with a shortened ending to Woods and Water, South Carolina. Welcome back to Woods and Water, South Carolina. I hope you enjoyed the replay of that interview with Dr. Kurt Verkaderin. A lot of good information in there. Like I said, I think we're all probably going to have to deal with the pigs sooner or later. They just hit those river systems and up they come. And they spread out from there. And trying to control them is a huge issue. So anyway, the rock I was referring to in the very, very, very short segment, first segment, was the National R3 Symposium out in Lincoln, Nebraska. It was a great couple of days out there, some busy days. I don't think I'm going to schedule any more 6 a.m. flights, that's for sure. But there were 323 people there, which is a big turnout. I think they were floored that many people came. It was a mixture of state wildlife agencies, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, National Wild Turkey Federation, Quality Deer Management Association, some wide mix, a couple of media members there, and it's going to be a big issue, and there's a lot of different talk about how to address recruitment, retention, reactivation across the United States, and I think there'll probably be some regional meetings
And then we'll probably have another one next year. So looking forward to see where that goes. One of the big things that came out that I thought was interesting, 25% of adult Americans live indoors. They spend two-thirds of every day inside. And that's not counting sleeping. That is not in that statistic. So, man, and so what role do hunters and fishermen who currently, like me, who currently live in the outdoors, what is our role in this? And what's the where do the non-contributors, and I don't mean that in a bad way, but the people that go take advantage of the outdoors, the birders, the bikers, the hikers, the campers, the backpackers, you know, where do they fit in? Because they don't have to pay into the system with a license or a boater registration or anything like that. So it's going to be an interesting process to see how this comes together and who steps up to fill in that gap. Will the millennials step in? Big movement among them to go to natural, you know, they're big on natural and whole foods. And wild game is as wholesome as you can get. And there's a lot of them that are getting into hunting for that very reason. That was another interesting thing that came out of it. So, but yeah, it is Memorial Day. It is a weekend and a day to remember those that died for this country. So I could do this show, so we can go hunting and fishing, so we can have the freedoms we do have. So I hope you'll take a minute to remember and talk about the meaning of Memorial Day. And I hope you have a great weekend. The calendar of events brought to you by Visit Anderson and Green Pond and Events Landing Center is very simple. Monday is free fishing day here in South Carolina. So find a piece of water, grab a rod and reel. You don't have to have a license. Go fishing. It'll do you good, I promise you. So as always, see you back here next week. Make time to get out there. Take the back roads when you can. Don't forget your camera. Enjoy Memorial Day. Yes, I'm gone.